Hello, my name is Carlos Pascual, Senior Vice President for Global Energy and International Affairs at IHS Markit, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to these CERAWeek conversations. For us, it's an opportunity to have these exclusive conversations with leaders in government, in industry, in academia, and finance who are tackling some of the major problems that we face globally around the world in the energy sector and in energy transition. And today we have the opportunity to engage with the Department of Energy in the process of innovation and entrepreneurship in government and how that's being used to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. And to help us lead that conversation, we have the Undersecretary of Science, Paul DeBar, and the Director of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, Thomas Zachariah. Paul, Thomas, a pleasure to have you in this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us here today. Always would rather be in Houston with you all like the previous years, but glad to have this conversation while we're in this environment.
Paul, thank you. We'll take that as an early commitment to CERAWeek 2021, and we'll look forward to having you there. Today, what we want to do is take you through this journey of the way that DOE is using its capabilities in national laboratories to be able to provide computing capacity, engage private partners, engage with other countries, and help use that in order to help us be able to find solutions to some of the tough challenges and questions that we're facing with this COVID pandemic. And Paul, if I could start with you, and tell us, how did the Department of Energy and the National Labs get involved in this fight against the COVID pandemic to begin with?
So if you think about the history of DOE, DOE is really the Manhattan Project. It came from the Manhattan Project, and the Manhattan Project basically evolved into the National Lab Complex, started off with the three original National Labs, including Oak Ridge and Hanford and Los Alamos. And what's happened over the decades is that we do research on a number of different areas, and we build out the capacity, and that can be switched kind of back and forth where we build facilities and we have researchers. The big four areas that really DOE focuses on from a broad science point of view with our various missions is materials, chemistry, physics, and biology. Those are the big four. And sometimes they're going after new generation batteries or how to look at geology with drilling, or it could be in national defense as we deal with strategic weapons, where we continue the mission of the Manhattan Project for the Department of Defense, or in a broad area of the sciences. And so we build facilities across that can shift back and forth that have a lot of flexibility to go, you know, one to one area or the other. A lot of people may not know DOE for this, but the DOE has a long history in biology. It all came from the nuclear program, where after World War II, we started taking a look at radiation damage for biology. That's kind of a lot of it where it came from. And subsequent to that, actually at Oak Ridge National Lab, a lot of the work around RNA and other parts of biology that we helped discover as a result of that sort of work. And we moved forward to where at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, we started the Human Genome Project. And the Human Genome Project that ultimately was executed at University of California, Berkeley. We have this long history in biology. So if you look at the lab complex, there are certain areas that support biology. And so we were able to build off of that everyday work that we do across the complex in computing, imaging cells, working with biotech drug companies, working with researchers. And it was very natural to kind of shift from that broad set of capabilities more into biology in the near term, more into biology under this public health crisis, came very naturally, and we were able to do it quite quickly.
Paul, let's explore those, both you and Thomas. And let's start with the computing side, because one of the programs you've developed is this High Performance Computing Consortium. Tell us what it is, who's in it, how it's working.
Yeah, so one of the first ideas that came out from us talking with IBM and the White House was that there was a lot of high-performance computing capacity in the country. The number one supercomputer in the world was built and run by Thomas at Oak Ridge National Lab, and it's by far the most powerful machine in the world. But there's lots of other high-performance computing capacity that can be used for a number of different things. And so us and IBM decided, why don't we try to aggregate all of that to try to very quickly turn around and start doing research rather than a multi-month process to take a look at proposals and allocation. How do we do it very quickly? So not only us joined and IBM, a lot of academia, so a lot of MIT and the University of Texas and others that have big supercomputing capacity, but we've had the biggest consortium of the tech industry focused on a national emergency really since World War II. So in this effort, we have not only IBM as one that's the leader along with us in this effort, but we have Amazon Web Service and their full computing capacity. We have Microsoft, we have Google, we have Hewlett Packard, we have NVIDIA and many others. And very interestingly, from an energy point of view, I think the biggest of the industrial owned supercomputers in the world is owned by BP. And they use their supercomputing capacity for geology and for drilling. And they have volunteered their effort, free capacity on their supercomputer for doing COVID research. So it's very exciting to have such a broad group, including a bunch of competitors in the private sector who normally don't normally compete against each other, all coming together to try to help the global community in this.
Thomas, can you give us some practical examples of how this is working right now?
Certainly. So as Undersecretary Dabar mentioned, this truly is a consortia and in both ways, both the private sector and the national labs. And we are 17 national laboratories that works as a system. And there is actually a Department of Energy has stood up what is called a National Virtual Biotechnology Laboratory that takes in all the proposals that comes into utilizing some of these things. There is actually a sub-team that is focused on utilizing these specific high-performance computing resources, and that this capability is made available on a priority basis to COVID-19 activities. And so it's actually working extremely well. I will say that especially capabilities like what Summit particularly offers is truly compute capability that generally people do not have access to. And so, for example, right now I know that there's a group trying to ingest a billion compound data set so that they can actually look at the efficacy of these compounds as for drug therapeutics, developing their drug therapeutic and their efficacy. And this is the first three-dimensional kind of calculation that they would have ever performed for something like this. Paul already mentioned some of the work that we do in epidemiologic modeling and other areas. So again, that is one aspect of it, is bringing the capabilities. But equally important, and I will tell you there's a human dimension to it, I've had a chance to talk to some of the scientists who are working on this, and they say that this pandemic has actually changed how science is done. It's become much more collaborative, both internal to the laboratory, within the laboratory system, but also across agencies and industry. So it's actually truly a testament of mobilizing the best capabilities, people, program, resources, and capabilities together to defeat this virus.
So let's take that point of the data that's being input on these compounds. Explain a little bit more about how the supercomputing goes from all of that data to something which is pragmatic about the development of a therapy. How does it make it go faster?
By now, almost everybody has seen the spike protease of the coronavirus, and that is used as a particularly efficient target for looking at compounds to attack. So how a chemical compound, in this case a drug, would dock with this protease so in order to defeat this virus. And what this particular study, among many, that is looking at is trying to run the analysis, screen these compounds as to how effectively it will dock to one, this is the spike protein is just one of the 10 or so proteins that they are really looking to see how the target will lock with the compounds in order to see what the effect is. Now, I don't want to make this just about computing. Simultaneously, they are using the light sources and the neutron sources that the department has at the various laboratories to experimentally validate how these compounds actually work in real experiments. So computing is driving experiments, and experiments in turn is driving forward the computational capabilities to accelerate the sort of rational design of drugs.
So in the end, the practical result of this is accelerating the process of testing either new compounds or existing therapies of what could potentially be effective against COVID-19.
Absolutely. That's exactly correct. What we're trying to do is to, because time is of the essence, and so making this iterative process as fast as it can be. And so, I mean, this compound study, the first time it's being attempted, will produce a result within a day that is unheard of.
Director Gottlieb, the former head of the FDA, and he was at the Wall Street Journal, and he was advocating that when you take a look at phase two trial data for therapies or vaccines, in a typical way, a drug company would do a trial, or a hospital, they would stop, take a look at the data, kind of be very methodical about how you develop a therapy or a vaccine. And he was making the argument that the data needs to be evaluated real time as the patients are reacting or not to a particular trial, and to have the decision evaluation process to be much faster. And so one of the things, in addition to looking at patient data, is also to take a look at trial data concurrently with the trial, and maybe multiple trials all happening over the world, taking a look at the impact of that real time and using the computing power to aggregate, look at that right away, and to try to identify faster than the norm, back to one of Thomas's points about how science is being done differently now as a result of this, is to speed up that process. And that's clearly another example of something that we're working on.
Fascinating. Paul, there's probably no bigger public policy debate in the country right now than how to reach the balance between protecting people and opening the economy. Is there a way that the supercomputing capabilities that DOE has is contributing to insights in that area?
Yeah, so as Thomas mentioned earlier, we're talking about epidemiology. And so a number of the labs are also working on the impact of the possibilities of the spread based on taking certain actions. Many of the times it's very localized in terms of the environmental impact of a particular location and population density and other drivers. And so as part of that modeling, we're very much a part of taking a look at that. And not only just taking a look at it, but helping provide advice. One particular example I can give is at the city of Chicago. We have a very big footprint at DOE in Chicago. We're very much very close to that very large city because we have two national labs there at Argonne and Fermi. And our partner for those operations include the University of Chicago, so right there downtown. So we've been the primary input for the for the city of Chicago to take a look at specific actions that they would take. So besides the general modeling opening up and potential spread or reduction in spread, we're actually doing some very practical advice in one of the major cities in the country.
Let me change the topic a little bit to human genomics. You mentioned it earlier, Paul, and this gets us into gene sequencing, and how is that study helping us better understand therapies related to COVID?
Yeah, so you know, if you think about, you know, there are two major drivers associated with the potential of any individual towards the severity of COVID. One's environmental, and environmental is, you know, what I would call if there's any predispositions because of age, because of weight, they're diabetic, they have an existing lung problems, So those are the big bucket of environmental. And then there's a possibility of there being a specific genomic marker or sequence that might predispose someone to catching it or having a more serious impact from it. We're not quite certain of that. We're reasonably certain of the sort of the environmental points. I think it's well discussed in the press. But frankly, we're still diving into that to make certain we really understand those drivers very well. But the genomic part is something that we certainly think there's a possibility of it. And the only way that we could do that is to collect enough patient data in terms of who's passed away, who's recovered, what are their environmental backgrounds, and then also collect the genomic data for enough patients. That's a bit harder. We need to try to get a big enough universe sample of people and try to see if there's any trends that, you know, once again, coming back to the computing aspects of the department, to see if there's a particular pattern associated with a sequence that that would aim someone towards being of higher risk. We don't know if that's necessarily the case, but we definitely have one of the research strings to collect the patient data on that and try to see if there is, that would point us in a way towards trying to some sort of therapy also as a possibility.
Another major impact area, which I imagine can also have a major difference or play a very significant role in dealing with the ethnic differences on how the COVID pandemic has been affecting people throughout the country.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And Thomas is leading this up in terms of, because of the number one supercomputer in the world, is to collect the current patient data and try to see what sort of the environmental points. We're at the very early stages. Our plan is to actually try to collect as much patient data from all the different sources in the country and even possibly work internationally. In terms of taking a look at patient data. But obviously, as discussed in the press and with some of the initial data, there does seem to be some driver around racial differences and the impact of COVID being having a higher impact of that, as well as other environmental aspects such as medical conditions. So those are absolutely important things that we're looking at, that we're beginning to see data that support the general press that people are commenting to.
Thanks, Paul. Thomas, you probably never imagined that you would be in the manufacturing business, but you are. Why don't you explain how?
Well, I think it's not surprising because the Department of Energy has a keen interest in advanced manufacturing to drive innovation, efficiency, and ultimately economic prosperity and competitiveness. So the manufacturing demonstration facility is a major Department of Energy facility that where we work collaboratively with, again, academia and industry. And in this particular case, we have focused on addressing a couple of pressing issues, as you have probably heard in the press. One is we have a manufacturing pilot line, which is intended for the main purpose is developing low cost carbon fiber for all kinds of manufacturing and production use. We were able to quickly repurpose that pilot facility to create N95 material, obviously for N95 masks. And so melt spinning in that production line to produce N95 material. And we got lucky because the inventor of N95 is a faculty at the nearby University of Tennessee. So we were able to leverage that capability. Likewise, we were also able to use our big 3D printing capability to quickly make molds for producing masks and other components, including something simple as the tubes for the testing kits, it's in short supply. And so there again, we have developed molds and we are also collaborating with industry to help develop these capabilities, transition to industry as quickly as we can so that they can scale up and produce in the millions of units.
I could keep talking with you guys forever. Paula, I'm going to give you the last word just on the international engagement that's been involved and how you've reached out to countries throughout the world to get input into the data collection process and the analytic process.
We've been in touch with and have interest from both the UK and Japan in particular, either coordinating or even possibly joining the US consortium to help do that aggregation and joint allocation of the research on a rapid basis. From a data point of view, as we talked about, the pulling together of patient data, the more patient data that we have, we'll see better trends, obviously, in what works and doesn't work, and can guide clinicians to actually doing things with individual patients. We've started conversations with different labs and kind of different groups within the complex with both Canada and the UK, and we hopefully will be able to work with them. It's always a bit, takes a bit of an effort with patient data and what's confidential and what can be aggregated versus individual and meet all the requirements. We actually have a full group working on this across the federal footprint of all the different agencies to help break down the barriers to collect that data. And we're certainly open to other countries who are open to sharing data back and forth and trying to figure out the patterns to do the best treatment.
It's important to recognize that this is a significant challenge. And let me say, from a laboratory's perspective, I always take pride in the fact that, as Paul said, Oak Ridge is one of those original three labs that were created at a time when people from all over the world came to this place where it was just muddy, and they were driven by the mission to win the war, to change the world. And in many ways, it is the same today, to win the war, to change the world. And that is really motivational for our staff, and I don't mean just Oak Ridge. For everybody who's involved in the system of labs, the collaboration between DOE and the partnership between DOE and the labs, among the labs and the academia. So it's that particular galvanizing moment in time, and I hope we can capture this essence and propel us for the next 75 years.
Thomas, thanks so much for sharing part of that DNA, which is embedded at Oak Ridge Lab, that commitment to public service, which obviously runs through every part of your thinking. Paul, thank you for sharing the thought about breaking barriers, because it's so much about what the work that you're doing is really trying to achieve, to take the spirit of commitment that you have, the computing capability that you've developed, sharing it with the private sector, bringing in other countries, and creating solutions. We welcome all of you to look up further the High Performance Computing Consortium at the link that we'll share with you at the end of this video. Thank you so much for joining us in the CERAWeek conversations with the Agora.